from KCPW in Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. For years, artifacts of Utah's past, dinosaur bones and ancient pottery and butterflies of all kinds had been shoved into every nook and cranny of a building on President Circle. It was a beautiful old building, but chronic plumbing problems and limited space threatened the collections, and University of Utah curators dreamed of a place where they could showcase, research, and preserve their 1.2 million treasures. This week, the dream becomes a reality when the new Natural History Museum of Utah opens to the public. And today on the program, we get a sneak peek from Museum Director Sarah George and the building's architect. Plus, form meets social function, using design to improve lives and society. All that in your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Early on, building a museum along the Bonneville Shoreline Trail raised some eyebrows, but supporters argued the positioning makes a lot of sense because in many ways, the new Natural History Museum of Utah is itself a trailhead with exhibits that introduce visitors to the history, science, and mysteries from all over the state. Today on the program, we're talking about what's inside the new Utah Museum of Natural History. Joining me in studio is Dr. Sarah George. She is Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah. She's a biologist by training and became the Executive Director of the museum in 1992. And Sarah George, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Also with us, Todd Schliemann is a founding partner and design principal at NEAD Architects. His work has been honored by the American Institute of Architects, both nationally and regionally, and his projects include the New York Hall of Science expansion in New York City and the Rose Center for Earth and Space at the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan, as well, of course, as the new Natural History Museum of Utah. And Todd Schliemann, thanks so much for being here as well.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Later on in the program, design meets humanitarianism, how good design can improve lives. But first, natural history. Did you vote for the bond to help fund the new museum? What kind of experience do you want from the Museum of Natural History? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Sarah George, first off, congratulations on the opening this week.
Thank you.
This museum has been a long time coming. How are you feeling about the result?
Well, we're thrilled, and I think we're very excited to show it to people because, of course, that is the ultimate test, is how people enjoy it and whether they're interested in coming back.
What is the mission of the Natural History Museum of Utah? How does this new Rio Tinto Center complement that those goals?
Well, our mission is to illuminate the natural world and the place of humans within it. And I think one of the key things that you'll see as you walk through is we are interpreting Utah's natural history, and we're also showing how people interact with nature throughout. So one of the interesting arguments we had internally is, in the dioramas in our life gallery, do we want them to be to show the impact of humans, or do we want them to be sort of what we consider pristine nature? And we compromised. Two of them you can see the impact of humans, and two of them you can't. And so I'll challenge people to go up there and see if you can find that.
Find the footprints.
That's right.
Before we get into some of the highlights on the interior and the architecture of the new museum, I want to touch on the journey that you've taken over the last few years. The Natural History Museum was housed for many years in the old library building on the campus of the University of Utah. When did you decide, you know, this is not working and it's not a good long-term solution?
This really took place in the mid-90s. We started to think about the future of the institution. We did a master plan. We looked at how our collections were cared for. And although we had wonderful staff, we had pretty wretched conditions. We looked at our market. It was very hard for people to find us. And once they found us, they couldn't park because we only had 12 stalls. We couldn't expand. It was difficult to work in that environment in a building that was not designed to be a museum.
It was designed for books.
It was. That's right. And the loading dock was the front door. Not so great for dinosaurs. So we started having internal conversations with the university. We took the conversation further and looked all over the valley at a variety of sites and settled on a site in Research Park right next to Red Butte Garden.
And what was it about this site that just really appealed to you, spoke to you, and supported the mission that you have?
Well, it was part of the university, and we are part of the university. We have faculty, graduate students, so that was important. It was adjacent to cultural organizations like Red Butte, the zoo. This is the place. It was adjacent to wildlands, and the opportunity to do something spectacular in that site was unsurpassed, and it enabled us to attract designers such as Todd and Ralph Applebaum, who did the exhibitions. The land was commercial land. It already had the plumbing, the electric that we needed, and so there were many, many reasons that supported the selection of that site.
But as I noted before, there was a little bit of friction, some pushback. What have you done to enhance the Bonneville Shoreline Trail? It is very close to the trail.
Well, of course, we did an environmental impact study that affected the design of the building and the placement on the site. And we spent a lot of time listening to people, what their desires and needs were. We have exterior galleries. We have put part of the site into a conservation easement with Salt Lake County. We have trails that head off into the foothills from the site. We are interpreting the exterior as well as the interior. We have a fountain for dogs, a water fountain for dogs, so they can get a nice drink as they're trotting up and down the trail. And we hope that this will be sort of a launching place for people who want to use the trails.
We're speaking with Sarah George, Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah. You've changed your name.
Yes, we did.
Why?
We amended it. Well, a couple of reasons. One, we thought it was important to note the transition of the institution. Secondly, people call us the Natural History Museum, and so why not go with the flow? And third, when people come to the university, they often confuse us with the Fine Arts Museum. So this helps both of us in distinguishing us.
Also with us, Todd Schliemann is a founding partner and design principal of NEAD Architects. He is the architect behind the new Natural History Museum of Utah. And Todd, what was the appeal? What was the draw of this particular project? You've done projects all over the world, all over the country. What was it about this museum project that kind of enticed you to throw in your hat?
Well, that's interesting. I was going to apologize because I'm from New York and Utah is so different. And I didn't really know the region very well, so I was interested. It's a very different context from the kind of urban scene from the Museum of Natural History that I worked on before. It's a fascinating place. I mean, as Sarah said, the landscape is just remarkable. I mean, I think I told Sarah early on that it's very architectural to me, the whole landscape, the variety, the kind of timelessness of it, and also the people. The people here are wonderful. I mean, the story that we were trying to tell with the building was all about how the people engage the land, you know, in the past and also, I guess, in the future. And that's what we tried to do with the building. So it was an enticement, you know, culture and nature, and it's what we hope the building looks like, feels like, and functions like.
I understand sustainability is a core value, a part of this building. How did you integrate that into the design?
Yeah, that's that was very important. The site was clearly very sensitive, as you've said. You know, we studied placing the building on various parts of the site to preserve it so that we wouldn't disrupt. There's a whole stand of beautiful gambrel oaks down at the base of the hill. The shoreline trail we tried to stay away from. We tried to keep the excavations limited. The building actually is half buried into the slope, which gives us the advantage of what we'll call a flywheel effect for heating and cooling, which allows us to save energy. And then there are quite a few things that we did to manage the water usage. We have retention tanks, which allow us to gather up the water from the hard roofs and then disperse it gently into the land so that we reduce erosion. We have high-performance mechanical systems. In a building like this, we have to have many air changes because the public is in it and bodies give off heat. We have to control the humidity so that the artifacts are preserved. We have to control the light, so we've used very limited amounts of glass. UV is dangerous for all these things. The list goes on and on. It's an important aspect. If this building had to be about the land and the people that use it, and that we do have a future, it had to be responsive. So it will get a LEEDS Gold rating eventually, and LEEDS Gold is not easy to attain. You have to prove after the building is built that it works, which is good. We like that challenge. It was a sensitive site, and the building is built from the site, into the site, you know.
Before we get into the interior spaces, maybe you can describe this building just looking at it. It's massive, but in many ways it blends into the hillside. It's built into the hillside. Mm-hmm. Describe, for those who haven't seen it, what it looks like visually from the outside.
Well, the base of the building terraces up the hillside. It's basically three terraced bars of building. In the center is a large opening, a large space we call the canyon, which organizes the galleries and all the administrative and labs and collection storage. But from the outside, as you arrive, it blends into the hillside. The outside is covered with copper that was donated from Rio Tinto, and it's begun to change. The idea there was that the patina of the copper would change over time, just like the hillsides do. I mean, the hillside changes seasonally, but right now it's a dark, deep, rich red brown. We use different kinds of alloys to stratify the facade so that it looks like a stratified rock cliff. The base of the building is a board-formed concrete, which looks like a kind of rock, which sprouts out of the ground, is faceted and broken, like you would expect. It's kind of an abstraction of the landscape. And as you arrive, the idea was you wanted to kind of traverse the hill and get up there slowly so that when you arrived, you were ready to see and receive the information that's in the museum.
And there are a couple of terraces, so people can go out onto these patios and really soak in the amazing view of the Salt Lake Valley.
Yeah, we have three terraces actually that face south. An example of that is the Land Gallery, where what's inside tells you about the kind of natural history of the land, which I call the foreground, because as you stand there, you can also look through a window and outside is a terrace, which is the kind of middle ground. It's the space between our understanding and the real landscape. And then you can look beyond and see the Wasatch Range come down and meet the valley floor. So it basically is a kind of connection between the past and our understanding of the past and what's actually there.
Sarah, when you saw the design initially, I mean, how did it speak to you? Did you think, wow, this is really what we were looking for? Or, you know what, I want this, I want that. But generally, I love the concept.
Well, the design process actually was very iterative. Mm-hmm. And they came to the selection process with a bunch of ideas. And it's interesting to go back and look at those ideas and realize that a piece of each one is in the final building. We went through a series of designs that either they didn't like or we didn't like, back and forth. And when I remember when you came out with this one, we all looked at it and went, that's the one we want. It was great. It was perfect. And very exciting to reach that point. It was really terrific. And we knew early on that we wanted copper. Mm-hmm. And we tried a lot of different ideas with copper, but this one felt right.
Sarah George is Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah. Also with us, Todd Schliemann, Founding Partner and Design Principal at NEAD Architects. And we're talking about the new Museum of Natural History here in Utah. 801-355-TALK if you'd like to join us. If you have questions, it opens this weekend. 801-355-8255. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Today on the program, an introduction to the state's latest cultural gem, the Natural History Museum of Utah. Did you get tickets for opening day, and how will you use this as a community resource? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. With us, Dr. Sarah George is the Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah. Also, the building's architect, Todd Schliemann, is with us. And let's go to the phones. And Laura is with us from Salt Lake City. Laura, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Just a quick set of compliments, really. My family are low-level charter members of the museum, and we were there for a sneak preview the other night. We already knew the outside of the beautiful. It's exquisite, so beautiful. But inside, we were blown away by the canyon, the layout of the museum as far as we got through it with our three little kids was very intuitive, exciting. The architecture actually leads you to the exhibits you want to see, and I just congratulations, and I encourage everyone to go.
Laura, thanks so much for those words.
Okay. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
801-355-TALK. That's kind of the proof in the pudding when people who haven't been involved in the project see it, embrace it, love it.
Well, I think Laura hit on something that we did that's a little unusual for museum design. We actually hired the architects and the exhibit designers together rather than having Todd design a black box and then come in later and decide what exhibits. And so there was a very complex but again iterative process to lay out the building and the exhibit so that they did work together.
Yes, it was very collaborative. Raph Applebaum and I have worked together before. We worked together at the Museum of Natural History in New York City and many other museums, so the collaboration was kind of easy. Mm-hmm. Well, I won't say it was easy.
No,
it took a long time and it was a struggle, but you know, there's nothing better than a struggle to create something like that. But, you know, an example of it is this idea of being able to link the landscape, the present landscape, with the exhibit content. You know, the lake exhibit, you know, there's the Ralph is working on the story of the lake in the past and in the future. And then what we needed to do was place a small window so that we could see the lake. And it was interesting. We had to send somebody up onto the hillside before there was any building there at all to make sure that that view was just the way it had to be. So we hooked this poor guy up with a GPS, got the altitude.
And a ladder
and the direction. Yeah, because it had to be 20 feet up in the air.
Uh-huh.
Take a picture, and that's the view that's there. So, but yeah, it's you know, making sure that people are comfortable also, that they're ready to see the exhibitry, to get them, you know, as Laura said, to get them comfortable and gracefully into the exhibitry, and so that they don't tire themselves out also. Mm.
Laura, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's take a virtual walkthrough, if we could.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we talked about was the canyon, this huge atrium. And what immediately caught my eye was the largest display case I've ever seen. I mean, it's stories high.
Three stories.
Talk about this glass case, what's in there, and what it represents. Sarah George.
Well, a very early concept was taking the collections that were in the back of house, the research storage areas, and filtering them down through the museum and all the way outside. And the first filter is this giant wall that separates the galleries from the back of house storage. So it's three stories high. It's glass on two sides. You can walk around it. We also had quite a discussion about whether to organize the objects scientifically in that case. Well, the objects on display are organized scientifically, so we turned it into an art display. So butterflies swirl up out of an old Navajo basket, and we have shells from the South Pacific. It's there to give people a sampling of what the research collections hold.
And then you continue on to the south side of the building, and you start to meander, as Laura described. It's almost like going through the forest. You're on a trail. You're discovering things. There are things to stop and see and experience and touch. Mm-hmm. Talk about the philosophy behind those interior exhibits and how it is so different from other museums that people may have been to.
Well, we wanted from the very beginning to have families be able to go through the museum together rather than separating display cases from discovery, hands-on areas. All of that is integrated. And we have a lot of media. So there are videos and audio sprinkled throughout the museum. There are even smells. You can smell the lake before a storm. We all know what that smells like. Tactile, and I mean, all your senses are engaged as you walk through. Visceral, thank
visceral.
You. That's a great word. We also wanted to make it easy for people to move through the space. Even though we're on the side of the hill, most of the galleries are connected by ramps, so you can easily move from one space to another without having to use an elevator or stairs. Another thing is we didn't want what you call a mediated pathway, where you start at point A and you're forced to follow a specific point to point Z. Although you can, there's probably a major walkway, you can enter the exhibits at any gallery and build your own pathway. And we're developing a Wi-Fi site with your smartphone that will give you options for different trails to use, and that will be debuting over the winter.
We're speaking with Sarah George, Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah, which opens this weekend. Todd Schliemann is the architect of the building. I want to talk about dioramas, because dioramas are a staple of any natural history museum. I think this museum handles them a little bit differently, a bit of twist to it. Sarah George?
Right. Well, again, I think I mentioned earlier that there's the human impact in some of them. But there are lots of things to do in the reader rails in front. And then, again, the architect working with the exhibit designer, the Life Gallery, has a fifth diorama, which is the terrace outside. So the foothill experience, you can actually go right outside and be in the foothills. So that's a fifth diorama in that space.
Again, linking the outside to the inside, you know, making the building connect with where it is. It's very important. You know, it's interesting. The building is on a hillside, and one of the challenges was, how do you get people to go up 50 feet through the exhibits without feeling as though they've gotten exhausted after
right,
the first 10,
right, yeah.
Which is this sort of meandering path up through the exhibitry, which gives them the chance to relax and see things along the way. And if they do get tired, they can go out into the canyon, look at people, go to a cafe, go to the shop, or maybe even leave the museum and want to come back later and reengage it in a different way. But you climb about 50 feet up to the top, and Native Voices, the gallery all the way at the top on the eastern side of the building, is a climb. But you just don't realize it, because there's so many interesting things to see along the way, and we've kind of choreographed a gentle way to see them.
Exactly.
The Native Voices exhibit, it talks a lot about the Native people who were here in Utah and Salt Lake. And you worked extensively with the tribes, I understand, to develop this exhibit. And in what ways did they help influence what we see at the museum?
Well, that part of the museum is a bit different from the rest of the museum. And we have an Indian Advisory Committee that we've worked with for many, many years on a whole slew of projects. And when we got to this point, we all went together to see the new National Museum of the American Indian, which doesn't talk about any of the Utah tribes. And on the way back, we agreed that this was a great opportunity to tell those stories. So it's not the scientist's voice or the museum staff's voice. We actually have invited the Five Nations here in Utah and also urban Indians representing other tribes in Utah to tell their own stories. So there are many, many voices. There are individual voices. We have, of course, spectacular collections. We commissioned some work for the gallery. There's some amazing audio stories, some of them in English, some of them in Navajo or other languages, all with closed captions for translation. You have an opportunity in that gallery to try your own tongue in learning some words of several of the languages as well. So it's an opportunity for you to contribute your voice to the experience.
Mm. I can't believe we've gone this far into the program and not talked about dinosaur bones.
Oh,
hello. That is the staple of natural history museums. Can you talk about some of the Utah contributions that we are seeing in these exhibits that haven't been shown to the public before?
Well, we have a very active paleontology program at the museum, and our guys are out in the field constantly. And Utah's incredibly rich. They find one or two new species a year. So this is the first chance we've had to show those species, and of course it's the first chance they've debuted to the world. So the gallery, which is called Past Worlds, kind of we wind down a ramp at eye level with some of these brand new dinosaurs. There's Gryposaurus. There's a new carnivore called Teratophonius, which is a cousin.
I love that name.
Isn't that a great name? I know. Who thinks these up? It's a cousin of Tyrannosaurus Rex. You wander down and you're in the Jurassic in the Cleveland Lloyd Quarry with a bunch of allosaurs attacking a barosaur. So it's a very immersive experience. And we don't just talk about the animals. We also talk about the environment that they lived in. So, again, you can get a little whiff of life in the Cretaceous. We even have bones in the floor with that you can walk over. They're laid out just as we found them in the ground, in the Grand Staircase or at the Cleveland Lloyd Quarry.
That actually was pretty cool because you could see, boy, I could never put together this puzzle. I'm glad there's somebody who knows how to do this. Another thing that I noticed in some of the text were pointing to evolution.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And you have a very strong statement on your website about evolution, calling it the cornerstone of modern science. Mm-hmm. Why did you feel it was so necessary to spell out this policy statement about evolution?
Well, that we also have a sustainability statement as well. And we want people to understand the basic premises that we do our research and interpretation at the museum. Evolution is a cornerstone of biological science. It's the organizing principle for how we analyze data and interpret results. And it's really important for people to understand that concept and understand that that is what we base our work on. The same is true for sustainability. We feel it's very important for people to understand the premise that we are doing our interpretation. It's the basis for decisions we made about the design of the building, and it's the basis for decisions that we're making about how we operate in the museum in the future.
We're speaking with Sarah George, Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah. Also with us, Todd Schliemann, who is the architect of the new building. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. And we'll go back to the phones, and John is joining us from Salt Lake. John, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, I had a question about the environmental assessment that was done. Because it seems to me that, well, I'm a little concerned about the location of the new museum, and I wonder if alternatives such as downtown were considered during that process, something that would have been more accessible to public transit. It seems like the location where it is going to increase vehicle miles and ultimately air pollution in the valley, which seems to be at odds with the purpose of the museum. And also, just on that point, I find it rather unbelievable that Rio Tinto, which is the largest air polluter in our valley, was allowed to sort of, you know, plaster its name all over this project.
Okay. So that's my comment. John, thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. To John's first point about not having a more centralized location, it's a little bit far out there.
It is.
Sarah George, describe why you selected this site. We touched on it earlier in the hour, but maybe reiterate.
Well, there were sort of two processes back in the 90s. We looked at a wide variety of sites all over the valley. And for the reasons I discussed earlier, we chose this. One of the key reasons is that it already is a cultural district. So the zoo is there. This is the place, Red Butte Garden. So it is an area where people who are looking for cultural experiences are already going. And so you might argue that putting us up there with those, in fact, we hope that people will be visiting two or more of those places in a day. Public access, of course, is a huge concern of ours, and starting with opening day, there is a free shuttle from Trax to the museum that leaves, I forget if it's every 15 minutes or every 30 minutes.
So, is this the Trax stop on the University of Utah campus?
Yes, it's the black shuttle. And then there are five UTA bus routes that stop a block below the museum. So it's not perfect, but we do have some public transit access, and we're going to be working to improve that.
And to John's point about your partnership with Rio Tinto, not exactly synonymous with environmental sustainability.
Well, we, of course, accept private gifts for the museum. Kennecott Utah Copper has been a partner with the museum for many, many years, and they have invested heavily in educational programs across the valley and actually across the state. And so when we opened the conversation with them about a major gift to the building, the university has a process in place for naming facilities. And we had the conversation with Rio Tinto. We were interested, actually, before they were ever involved, we were interested in covering the building with copper. And that's, in fact, how the conversation opened. And we made the decision to brand the building with the name. But the museum is still the Natural History Museum of Utah. And we hope that Rio Tinto is, well, we know that they are concerned about sustainability as well, and they have proven to be good partners with us in the areas of safety and in education as well. So it's we understand that there are concerns, and we hope that people will come and enjoy the experience at the museum.
And in the interest of full disclosure, Rio Tinto is also a supporter of this station, KCPW. 801-355-TALK. John, thanks for the call. In addition to all of the public spaces that the museum is offering, it really is a research institution as well. Sarah George, can you talk about the labs and how the building is being used by students and by faculty at the University of Utah?
Well, our research curators actually hold faculty positions. And the north side of the building is research labs, the collection storage, and it provides it provided kind of a challenge for the architects to think about how to lay out that space and provide the conditions.
How'd you
that
do
we
it,
need.
Todd?
Well, it's interesting because we the museum is actually, you know, one side of the canyon space, which is what everyone sees. is the science side. This is where the collections are. This is the place where the research gets done, where Sarah is. I call it the empirical side. This is how we understand the natural world, by taking things apart, and people specialize in very, very small parts of the world so that we can understand them better. And then on the south side, the galleries that everyone sees, is the interpretive side. That's the place where you get to see things as they are, and then with the science, understand them. So one part is science, and the other part is the kind of human reception of the natural world. So it was a challenge, but it seemed to work out quite well. We had we really did want to try to expose some of the science so that people can understand that a little bit better, because sometimes it can be a mystery. Mm-hmm. Those names of all those dinosaurs are hard to pronounce. That Barosaurus, I think we used to call it a long neckosaurus,
right,
because it was more accessible.
Yeah.
But this, you know, the science, trying to make everything accessible is important. Mm-hmm. And that's why we actually wanted people to be able to see into collection storage area. It's usually hidden away. Mm-hmm. And that's a nice thing. So we want people to understand.
And then, of course, that's where our graduate students and undergraduates do their work. But we have some really cool learning labs that are attached to the galleries, mm-hmm, that can do duty as classrooms or as extensions of the galleries. They kind of look like 19th century cabinets of curiosity. And we, of course, invite school groups to come. Public schools in Utah can visit the museum free of charge.
Our time is short. Sarah Georgia, finally, what are you hoping that people take away from a museum visit? Is it a single visit? Is it multiple visits?
Well, I hope they come back. I think the experience is so rich that they will. I hope that they walk away saying, I want to go out to all these places in Utah. It's such an extraordinary place we live in, and I really want them to explore it further. That's important. I want people to understand that we're learning more and more about this world we live in as time goes on, and I want them to have fun.
Dr. Sarah George, Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah, which opens this Friday to the public. More information on our website, kcpw.org. Sarah George, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Todd Schliemann, a founding partner and design principal of NEAD Architects and the architect for the new Natural History Museum of Utah. And Todd, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Up next, Salt Lake Design Week comes to town, and with it, a challenge to design for good. But first, a quick break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.